episode 23 of the Thinking Habits podcast, and today we're going to be talking about music. I'm Simon.
Hi, I'm Pam. I was just about to remind you about introductions.
I always forget. People know by now. And the reason we did, well, we've been wanting to do a music one for a while because music's quite important in both our kind of lives, and we've bonded on a few different bands and things, but particularly music and mental health, it's something that's really, I've certainly, they're intrinsically linked for me, definitely, I think.
Yeah, I think everyone has, if not specific songs, then types of music that cheer them up. And, you know, I think it's something that people, one thing that people definitely divide on is, if you're sad, do you like to listen to sad music in a kind of cathartic way, or do you like to listen to upbeat, happy music, cheery songs? And I think for me, certainly, it's a bit of both, and it varies time to time.
Yeah, but it really, really depends on my mood. I will listen to, you know, I will listen to really angry, growly death metal sometimes when I'm in a bad mood, but sometimes I need something that's really like bright and uplifting as well. It really depends.
Yeah, I think sometimes you just need to indulge the bad mood for a bit, really.
Yeah.
And you know, it's just like, I'm grumpy, so I'm going to wrap my lip over the top of my head and be really grumpy.
Yeah, well,
and then I'll be fine.
A bit of you know, cognizant wallowing is fine.
Yeah.
You know, as long as you don't, you know, disappear down that rabbit hole. I mean, I did a bit of reading around it as well, rather than it just being a kind of opinion piece. Mind talk about it a lot. I mean, there was a study in 2011 that directly linked music to dopamine receptors in the brain and certain feelings that you get listening to certain songs. And, you know, there's that Requiem for a Dream piece that's used loads and loads.
That
crescendo piece that's used in that film, which was incidentally also used in the trailer for Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers.
Yes.
Before they'd done the soundtrack
for
that.
Yeah, I remember that.
And that piece is very, it's designed, there's certain frequencies that are deliberately used for those kind of pieces of music that really kind of well up and produce a tangible emotional response.
Yeah,
people,
well, they've done, in the same vein, they've done studies around the acoustics of churches and the way it's built, the way the building is designed, and the acoustics of the building mean that especially organ music and certain types of music will provoke a spiritual, emotional response, and it's what we thought to be. And to me, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
You'll get people spontaneously crying, and you know, I've been in situations where, something like that, and I've been in a perfectly good mood, but then all of a sudden I've heard music
and it's really affected
me. It really affected me, and I always, well, certainly since my teens, I've been very emotionally responsive to music.
Yeah, it's interesting about the teens thing. We'll come back to that because that's quite an interesting thing, but just before I forget, there's also
I interrupted your stream that you were talking
about. No, we'll get back to it, it's fine. West Kennet Long Barrow, there's a burial site down south where is it Neolithic? I think it might be Neolithic.
Yeah.
I'm more than open to being corrected. This is all off the top of my head, but the Long Barrow itself, we're slightly off topic, but it's relevant that when they buried their dead, what they'd do is they'd leave them out. They're called excarnation burials. They'd leave them out to basically decompose and then separate out the body parts. So when they found this Long Barrow, there was a room with just legs in it, room with just head, you know, skulls in it, room with just, you know, ribs and whatever, and that was the way that they honoured their dead. But the actual resonance in that chamber down the main corridor is something that archaeologists believe was deliberately created to produce vibrations at certain frequencies.
Yeah, it's only been in recent. I remember seeing something about that on I can't remember what it was, some Discovery Channel programmes, I think it was years ago, but they'd only recently had equipment sensitive enough to re- to be able to record the actual resonance and translate it into sound waves. And it was basically the way the air moves through the chamber, it creates a sort of subsonic sound that humans can't consciously hear it, but it obviously, you can register it, people can register it at some level, and it's been suggested that it was created so that you would feel that this was a spiritually significant place, and that's why they built it the way they did. But they said, and the program was more like, it's incredible that it was talking about human ingenuity, and it was incredible that they were able to put this stone chamber together, because it was obviously a very deliberately created chamber. It wasn't like they just found this cave and it just so happened that you reacted like that. But was it just trial and error that they were putting it together, and like, okay, this, and someone's went, this feels right, because they didn't have all the technology that they were using to then, say, oh, right, so there's this sound wave and this frequency appears to affect humans like this. Yeah.
But then you see that a lot in things like Tibetan chanting and monastic chanting. There's that one. I mean, when we used to go to yoga together, there's that, you do your om thing.
Do the oms at the end.
There's certain pitches. I can feel that. It makes my whole head shake.
Yeah, you get the... I certainly get a certain... For me, it's actually quite a low register for my voice. But I know when it kind of feels right in the back of my throat.
And
like you say, into your chest and into your head. And it's not a register that I would ever speak or sing at. I would struggle to maintain it. But, it is odd how it kind of affects you like that.
And resonant frequencies. I mean, Nikola Tesla used to mess around with resonant frequencies. He had this vibrational device that tuned mass damping, is what people use it for now. So what it's used for now is you'll find the resonant frequency of a building, and they'll hang a really heavy weight at the top of the building, so it will react against seismic movement. So if a building's wobbling, then this huge weight counteracts it. But that's kind of tangentially linked to the resonant frequency. But on the opposite end of that, Nikola Tesla invented a vibrational machine that he could alter to find the resonant frequency of a building. And it was his belief that if you made one big enough, you could destroy a building just by shaking it.
Is it true? Or is it a myth about when you're marching across a bridge, you break step just in case the march matches the resonant frequency?
They did it on Mythbusters, although it was early Mythbusters, and they made these little kind of like wind up doll shoes with hats, and it didn't really
Didn't the bridge break just through them using it, but the bridge broke
because they jumped up and down on it and smashed it. But
I thought there was some reason they weren't able to fully complete the experiment. I vaguely remember that episode.
The anecdotal evidence is that it does happen, but as to actual research as to whether or not that is possible, I think the problem is the only way you could really recreate it is to march a load of soldiers over it in step, and risk harming people. So
is it a In theory, it could.
But I remember
march has a resonant frequency and a solid object.
Dad, when he did his military service, he was always taught to break step. They always broke step over bridges. But as to whether or not there's been any robust scientific sort of research into it, I don't know. But I will try and use the multitude of search engines while we're talking to see if we can. We've gone a little bit off music, but I suppose it's all tied in. Resonant frequencies and things that become very powerful to you can produce a physical reaction, but also there's the emotional reaction. So going back to the Mind article, there's a person on the Mind website who's talked about music and their mental health, and how as a teenager and as a young person, certain historical events or activities or things that happened in their lives are intrinsically linked with music, and I absolutely link to that. There are songs now that I've listened to, I first listened to when I was 14, 13, and I am like, there's a song, Drift Away by Dobie Gray, which I first heard when I was 9, and I can picture my mum and dad's car, and I know exactly where I'm sat in the car when that song gets turned, the tape gets turned over, and that song is playing on the other side.
Yeah,
just after it's just after it started, and we're pulling into a parking space in Ipswich, and whatever else happened during that day, it could have been the most monumental. You know, I could have bought a new Star Wars toy. You know, the most important thing to an 8-year-old. But that, for some reason, that I don't know why, but there's that is there. It's like rubber stamped in my head, and I don't know. It doesn't have any overwhelmingly powerful or positive or negative connotations. It's just a Polaroid of a particular event, and it's that song.
Yeah,
which seems really weird because I would expect it to have more relevance and resonance other than just being a thing that happened.
Well, is it?
Because a lot of other ones did.
Yeah,
so,
but you know, they always say it's not always big major. You know, people struggle to remember. You know, the things that you think would be memorable, or like, be it traumatic or good or bad experiences, life experiences, and it's always a little detail that will stand out to you rather than the actual event itself. You probably created some, you've altered the memory and you not remember it quite right, and someone else who was there would remember it very differently.
Yeah.
But there'll be certain little details that you have pinpoint accuracy on, and you know, or you'll have there'll be a real clarity around like a certain, and if you hear a song, for example, or smell a certain smell, and it will take you back to that pinpoint moment. And I mean, I've got, I don't know, everyone has lots of those.
It's, yeah, listening to Vulgar Display of Power by Pantera, although I don't really listen to that anymore, listened to that for the first time, and it still now reminds me of putting together my first fish tank.
Yeah.
Because I bought a fish tank in town, and I bought that album at the same time, so I was playing it while I was making it. When I was making the fish tank. So that's an odd one, because they are, you know, they are idiosyncratic. That's odd.
Yeah, but you know, it's it was something that was important to you, and it was an album that was important to you for a long time.
And I think the fact that I was, you know, I was going through my uber hormonal years when grunge was big.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, my top five albums still contain Smashing Pumpkins, Siamese Dream, Pearl Jam 10, Nirvana In Utero, you know, those kind of things, you know. Yeah. And in Nirvana In Utero, I find it's a brilliant album, but I find it a very, very difficult listen, because I lumped a lot of my teen angst into that album.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas I can listen to 10. 10 doesn't, 10, even though 10 is, you know, it's just as current, and I was going through the same things at the same time.
Yeah.
That album, it just, I don't know, I think it's because it's so dark, and it,
yeah,
and you know.
And I think Nirvana's a lot more associated with teen angst.
Yeah, I think it is, but I don't, but.
And they told, you know, Kurt Cobain was much more of a kind of tragic figure, or, you know, he's become that kind of icon of 90s teen angst. And
that's true, but, you know, as far as, I think, I'm careful not to associate it with, you know, what happened to him after, you know, after 1984, because this is when it came out. So, but yeah, I get what you mean.
Yeah,
I get what you mean. But yeah, it's very strange. And then there's articles that said recently that the reason why people, you know, I listen to new music. I do, but I do end up as a comfort blanket, I do go back to the music of the 90s.
Oh yeah, well, when we were I was sorting through our CDs and putting them so we could put the case in the loft and, you know, other boring storage talk, domestic stuff. But the, you know, there's some old classics in there, and you know, and obviously we don't buy CDs so much anyway now because of Spotify and other music streaming services are available.
Yeah.
But it's the bulk of it, I'd say 90% of it is from the 90s.
Yeah, absolutely.
And part, I think from my part, it's the time of my life when it's sort of the first sort of time where I had disposable income.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you like to, you don't really have anything to spend it on. I was too young to be going out, and I looked too young to be even trying to go to pubs and stuff. And, you know, I lived at home. I was still at school, still at college, so I wasn't paying rent or anything. So I didn't really have an awful... the majority of my money, all I spent my money on was clothes, music and books. And And it was more money than I'd ever had before, and it seemed to go quite a long way.
Mm.
But you know, things like buying stuff as it came out, so it would be when it was cheaper, because they always seem to do that like often. Our price and other record shops, they do like where the first week it was out, it would be.
But yeah, I suppose you're right. I mean, at the end of the day, I think as well, when you go back to when we were in our teens, you had the ITV chart show.
Yeah.
You had Top of the Pops.
Top of the Pops was still a big thing,
although,
wasn't it?
Yeah, we can't really talk about that anymore, as it's heavily tarnished. Yeah. But it was important. It was a big thing. You know, it was a big thing. And it introduced a lot of people to new music. The Radio 1 chart show, Top 40, Bruno Brooks represent.
Yeah.
And that, you know, other than like Melody Maker and NME, that was about it, really.
Yeah.
Unless you had MTV or Sky, because, you know, I was like 13 or 14 when Sky came out, and so there wasn't that many people with MTV.
No.
And it was only when I started working in a pizza shop at 16 that I got to see MTV. I got to watch Headbangers Ball, I got to watch, you know, Unplugged and all these things, and it got introduced to new music. So prior to that, the avenues where new music could be heard was, and it was things like John Peel, know, so you'd hear these things and you'd follow certain paths. So if you liked what John Peel liked, I think you were very much open to an eclectic mix. I'd kind of dip in and out of that, but it was much narrower than it is now.
Yeah,
you've got so many different ways of getting hold of new music now.
I'm finding out about more alternative stuff. It would usually be if you liked something, reading interviews with those bands, and then they'd talk about their influences.
Yeah.
And you'd kind of go down that rabbit hole and find out about stuff that way. But you had to seek it out a lot more than I think you do now.
Yeah, definitely.
But, pulling it back to mental health, I really can't remember where I read it or heard it, and it's probably numerous different places that I've seen it said that most people, most of their favourite music will be from the sort of mid to late teens, and it's all tied around, it's when you sort of start to form your own opinions about the world. And
is that, but also on a chemical level, they believe that it's because you are so, your hormones are all in flux, and your brain chemistry is still, you know, it's fluctuating more rapidly than it would be at any other time, really, in your life. They reckon that it forms a kind of footprint, which is quite hard. And I suppose if you've got that hormonal flux, and you're in a position where you're discovering your own identity, and your identity when associating yourself with a peer group who also like the same things, when it matters beyond just, you know, playing with the same toys as a child and whatever, then that's an incredibly powerful stamp to put on your personality. And whether it's good or bad, you know, like listening to Nirvana, a lot of the memories I associate with that album are, I mean, by a 42-year-old's standards, completely unimportant. But for a 16-year-old, they were the most important things that had ever happened to anyone ever. So from an emotional intelligence point of view, that they are, there's nothing more important than that. And I think that's, and so I will forever remember, you know, those certain elements and those certain events while listening to that music.
Yeah, I think it. I mean, it's a really interesting idea, just because. Yeah, going back to, I mean, my favourite album, you know, anyone who knows me will know what it is, because it's, I've got all the artwork tattooed on my arm. But Smashing Pumpkins, Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness. I mean, I do like, I think Siamese Dream is a brilliant album, but
that's my favourite.
It's a lot of people's favourite, but Melancholy, when I got it, when I first listened to it, because I think it's best, it's one album that, and I don't think you get that so much anymore, it works as a piece of, you should listen to it as a complete piece of music, rather than just dipping in and out of tracks. I mean, dipping in and out of tracks is great, because most of what's on it is great, but there are certain tracks that, listen to out of context, don't seem that great. But if you listen to as a whole piece of music,
it works.
It absolutely works. And I think, you know, I was 15 when I got that album, and because I got it for Christmas, and when I first got it, I was like, what's this? Because the only track I'd heard off it was Bullet with Butterfly Wings.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people who got it when it came out, that's all they'd heard.
Yeah.
I'd heard Bullet with Butterfly Wings, and I'd read two reviews of it.
Interestingly enough, I bought Siamese Dream on the basis of hearing a snippet of Today and reading the Melody Maker review.
Yeah. Well, actually, Today is my favourite Smashing Pumpkins song, but it's not on. But yeah, when I first got it, I was like, "Oh, I'm not sure about this."
Yeah.
So I gave it, but I gave it a few more listens, and every time I listened to it, I got more out of it. And I think that was my album that I really, that was probably the first time that I really formed an emotional connection to a record. I mean, there'd been music that I loved, but that was the first time that I really formed an emotional connection to an album, and so much that I would, or couldn't, if people didn't like it, I couldn't understand why. So even if you know, because it's, and I still get a little bit of that, even though it's like, how can you not appreciate all this, and you know, all these different layers to it, and you know, it's quite interesting to think back to.
Yeah, no, I agree, absolutely. Smashing Pumpkins, Siamese Dream, I know every beat of that album. I know the gaps in the music. I know the, you know, I know all the little clicks and whirs and this that and the other. Same with the Neutro, same with Ten, same with a lot of Pantera stuff. See, that would be an interesting thing to mention. The reason I don't listen to Pantera was because of the whole Phil Anselmo thing. Now, for those of you who don't know, Phil Anselmo is quite an outspoken person in the you know, the metal scene, and it came to a head at a festival a couple of years ago, where he started making white power salutes on the stage, and was widely vilified, and rightly so, for the things that he was saying.
He did actually shout white power, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, and amongst other things. And he, you know, he's since come out and, you know, and been very penitent and said that he's been, you know, re-educating himself. And while I am a huge fan of the music, at the time when it all happened, I couldn't disassociate the things that he'd said from the music that he'd written. And I found that very difficult, because I'd idolized the band for so long, and then somebody said to me, you know, within reason, there needs to be an ability for a consumer to separate the artist from the art. Now, obviously, there's certain things that you cannot do that with, and I still struggle a little bit with Pantera. You know, I mean, I've got a Pantera tattoo on my chest. I've got one of the lyrics, "By Demons Be Driven," tattooed on my collarbones, and I use that's a mantra for me. "By Demons Be Driven." I read what I want to read into that. But at the same time, it really upset me, and it really made me sad that somebody who I looked up to musically was such a prick. And I just couldn't listen to it. And that's really sad. And it's almost, and that shows for me, that really brought it home for me, what it's like and how powerful music is. Because that did feel like a bit of a breakup, because I was listening to that almost every day. You know, I used to do a long commute. I'd listen to Far Beyond Driven and Vulgar Display of Power and every day. They're on my Spotify playlist. That, you know, I collected everything, every album. I even got his weird death metal solo work that he did with his wife, which is frankly dreadful. but I really got into Down, because that's like doom metal and sludge metal, and it's brilliant. You know, as music, it's brilliant. But what that did was that pulled a huge band-aid off. You know, when the frontman, whose name escapes me, from Machine Head, put the YouTube video up calling Phil Anselmo out for all the times he'd been, you know, racist and really horrible backstage and stuff, and all this other stuff started coming out about music and stuff, and about the whitewashing of bad behaviour like that, and ignorance and bigotry in music. And a lot of commentators were saying, well, if you stop listening to music for the sake of controversy, you wouldn't listen to David Bowie, you wouldn't listen to the Rolling Stones, you wouldn't listen to the Beatles, you wouldn't listen to you wouldn't listen to anything. And yes, that is true. And there's things that come out about John Lennon, he wasn't a very nice person. There's things that come out about David Bowie, you know, morally questionable. There's things that come out about a lot of people.
Yeah.
Because people are people. People do bad things. That, you know, when we raise people aloft and we idolise people, it shouldn't be as surprising when they get knocked off their perches, because people do get knocked off their perches.
Yeah, I found it. It's Rob Flynn from Machine Head. I was looking that up.
Yeah.
When we saw the Joe Rogan interview with Billy Corgan from Smashing Pumpkins, and I kind of had the idea that you know, they say never meet your idols, and I had a feeling that he was not a very nice person. And because there's all the stories about him being a complete control freak, and when the Smashing Pumpkins were imploding, him insisting on doing absolutely everything, like recording it all himself in recording studio and it being tracked, doing all the guitar tracks, and he did everything except the drums, really. And they're not without the controversy. You know, there was was it a keyboardist?
Yeah, Jonathan Melvoin died after Jimmy Chamberlain gave him.
Yeah, and he's had his own.
Yeah, he's got his own trouble with drugs and stuff. Yeah,
but yeah, listening to it, and it just seemed to view it as much more of a sort of corporate enterprise almost, and commercial, and he came across as very capitalist. And you know, when he was talking about saying he was advised to say the music was written by the Smashing Pumpkins so they could all share in the royalties, and he was like, well, no, because I wrote it, it's mine, why should I share it? And part of me is like, well, yeah, okay, but you couldn't, you know, when you're touring everything, you can't play it all on your own. And
although he has managed to trot out several tours with, you know,
with session musicians and stuff. Yeah, he had, and part of it. It didn't sit very well with me. Mm. I don't really know what I'm trying to say.
I think I know. I'm guessing, because I think I feel a very similar way. You paint the picture that you want to paint about the people you idolise. If something is important to me and it resonates with me, I generate an image of that person that reflects what I would like to see in them, given what I see in what they've given to me. And when that isn't 100%, you end up feeling a sense of loss and detachment from the people you idolise, which is frightening.
Yeah, I think I'd built up an image, certainly in my late teens and early 20s, of how through the music. Mm. And I think a lot of people do that. You know, you think you know someone because you listen to the music and they'll talk about, you know, writing. Some of the lyrics come across as, you know, deeply personal. Mm. So you build this image up, and then when you realise that actually they're just a normal person, mm. and you read things that you don't like, and you think, well, I think instead of going, well, everyone has their off days, mm. and you know they might just have been.
What was it? What is it to say? The higher you are, the further you fall. So
yeah, yeah, and I think, you know, sometimes you hear bad things about people, and it turns out actually they were just ill that day, or they were just yeah. having a you caught them at the wrong moment.
Mm. But it's like, I remember years, and I mean, it's not really, it's kind of relevant. I remember somebody when I worked in a bookshop saying, you know, always try and be friendly with customers, because if they like you, if they like the shop, they'll tell one person. If they don't like the shop, they'll tell 10 people.
Yeah.
And that's why you only ever see the gossip headlines and the tabloid press and all this stuff. You only ever see negative stuff because that sells papers, yeah. and that's the stuff that people want to hear about. They want the things that bring their idols closer to them.
Yeah.
And the lofty going off into the stratosphere stuff takes them further away.
Yeah, so and so is a really nice guy. Yeah. He's probably never going to make, because people reactions just like,
yeah,
that's good.
Although almost universally, that's interesting actually, because almost universally, I've heard that Robert Plant is an incredibly nice person.
Oh right,
yeah.
And so that was my, and there's my reaction.
Yeah,
so all right, that's good. Yeah. Whereas you say someone's like, really, what did they do?
Yeah,
and you know,
but then it can go too far as well, because it's like, you know, you hear things like Axl Rose did another thing, and it's like, oh right, okay, well it's Tuesday, he's gonna hurt. So
yeah,
you know, so sometimes it can
pop
be
bitch, the ultra mental Axl Rose.
Yeah, but then sometimes there's a persona element to that as well, that's characterized by, you know, the rock and roll musician, the TV out the window kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which is encouraged, isn't it? Because they said that about when Monty Python went on tour. Monty Python went and stayed in a hotel, and the manager of the hotel encouraged them to smash up the bedroom, and they refused. And so, as a sop to the manager, Michael Palin went back into the room and snapped a toothbrush.
What? Because they wanted the publicity.
The publicity of Monty Python smashing up the bedroom is worth far more. To them, or Monty Python, or Led Zeppelin, or Guns N' Roses, or whatever, is worth far more to them in adjunct revenue to the hotel than it is to repaint and refurbish a hotel room.
So I mean,
it's kind of, that kind of nonsense has died away now a bit.
Yeah,
I think.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure that the staff who were stuck with the cleanup.
No,
after some of the things you read about, I'm not sure they would agree.
Yeah, working in hotel services, I have the utmost respect for anybody who does that, because it must be dreadful, absolutely dreadful. Music. It's weird. I think for me, what's really interesting is when because I, you know, I'm old enough to have been around since, you know, the internet was wee, and you know, the birth of file sharing and Napster and LimeWire and. Bear Share, was that one of them? Was that called Bear Share? Something like that.
I don't remember.
Napster was the big one.
Napster, LimeWire. See, now it's associated. Napster was the big one, and yeah. LimeWire was the one that gave you computer viruses.
Oh, LimeWire was just PC gonorrhea. It was just
Was Napster streaming, or was it down? Because LimeWire was downloads, wasn't it?
It was, but LimeWire was more torrent. Kind of, whereas Napster was a different file sharing system.
Yeah,
but
because I suppose streaming, the people didn't have the bandwidth capabilities to do streaming really.
Yeah.
Until relatively recently.
I think for me Napster was interesting for me, because what I did with Napster was a lot of it was stuff I already had, so I had it on tape. But I didn't have it on CD, but I'd already bought it, so I'd get an electronic copy, so I could play it on my computer. And then, because at the time, you know, your CD-ROM drive would rip a CD, you'd have to play it, you know, it would rip it that slowly.
Yeah, yeah.
But then it was things like...
Or you get it be corrupted.
Yeah, but there was Japanese imports that you'd never get over here unless you went into HMV and paid like 75 quid for a CD because their business model is just picked out of thin air.
Yeah.
But there was things that you couldn't get. That's what I use Napster for.
Yeah.
There was a few albums that I got. But
trying stuff out.
Yeah.
But we're not here to talk about
the legalities of that. But I'm also quite a completist as well. So if I did like something, I like the sleeve notes, I like the artwork and stuff. But I think I've kind of come to terms with the fact that it's all changing so much now with Spotify and Tidal and all these other, you know, Deezer and all the music sharing streaming stuff. But I think Spotify has matured a little bit and as a result has opened me up to a lot more new music.
Yeah, I think the algorithms on recommendations are a lot better.
Mm.
And I think, you know, it's become another way to discover new music.
Yeah.
Because
you can start like it's almost like the Apple Music Genius playlist. You can start a radio station based on the one track you've picked, and it'll pick similar things. And I found some really interesting stuff. And there's a lot of podcasts that have an ancillary soundtrack. So last podcast on the left, they did an episode about David Bowie's links to the occult, because David Bowie was obsessed with the occult, and they did a David Bowie playlist referencing all of the tracks in his playlist, in his discography, that had strong occult elements in the lyrics, which was it's really interesting.
Really interesting, mm. Yeah. And the way they discussed lyrics about the extra meaning, and saying that they'd been listening to that particular song for years and years,
yeah,
and then only just found out that. Only just heard that lyric,
yeah,
or only just sort of read it and realised the context, and then it makes you see the song in a whole new light. And
yeah.
I've had experiences like that when I've mainly been listening on headphones to music, and a certain line that I've never really noticed before,
yeah,
has jumped out at me.
Resonated differently.
Resonated differently, or I've picked up on it, and it totally changes my perception of the song.
Yeah. I think that's the wonderful thing about songs. Like, there's an album that I didn't. There's an album from 1991, Stereo MCs Connected, and I, you know, everybody's heard Connected. Everybody's heard the other one. I can't remember. I can't remember the other one. But there's songs on that album.
Word up.
No, that's Cameo.
That's Cameo, yeah.
Yeah, or Korn, if you're an emo. But there's songs on that album that I hadn't heard for 15 years. Not even once, not even, you know, in passing. And I knew every single word and every single part of that song because I listened to it so much. And it's really interesting how it really ingrains itself in your brain, music. Because I can read a book over and over and over again, and... You know, like I've read Infinity Welcomes Careful Drivers by, you know, the Red Dwarf book.
Yeah, the first Red
probably
Dwarf.
15 times.
Uh-huh.
But it doesn't have the same... I suppose it's not as easily absorbed in the same... I suppose it's not absorbed in the same way. Maybe it's the brain patterns or whatever. But I find that amazing that if I haven't listened to a song for that long, I can still pick up the nuances of the song as if I listened to it again when I was 15.
Yeah, yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, little things that you didn't know your brain had held on to.
Mm.
Song lyrics. If someone asked you to sing a song from something, you probably couldn't do it. But
yeah,
as soon as you're actually listening to it,
yeah,
you know every word. Like... Pulp, Different Class.
Yeah.
I think the only track that I would know off the top of my head, always is Common People.
Yeah.
But I can sing along to the entire album.
Thing, yeah.
And it always makes me, because I had that on cassette. I got it for Christmas one year. The year it was out, obviously. But in the liner notes, it's got all the lyrics, but there's a little message saying, asking you not to read the lyrics along while you're listening to it.
Really?
Yeah.
Because
it's Why? I think because if you're concentrating on reading, you're not experiencing
I started. It's not like Jarvis Cocker to be profound, is
it? Well, yeah. See, it spoke to me a lot as a teenager, but then I listened to it again quite recently, and it has a completely different meaning to me. I mean, there's the whole. When I was a teenager, it was a very personal thing, and it was like being a disaffected teen, and I feel like you didn't quite fit in. And I know on the John Robbins and Ellis James podcast that we listened to, where they talk about music on the Keep It Sessions.
Yeah.
And John Robbins did Pulp, and he was talking about it made it okay to be a bit weird and okay to not fit in. And he's a little bit younger than me, so I think he would have come to it younger when Pulp were out.
Yeah.
But I think I was about 14, 15 when Different Class was in the album charts.
That makes good sense, because I was 19 when I saw them.
Yeah. So. And you know, it was a very sort of personal thing, like it's okay to be a bit different and everything. But then listening to it as a 37, 38-year-old,
yeah,
you kind of realise that there's a lot...
You're still disaffected.
I'm still disaffected, yeah. And I've never really grown out of that. But it's a more societal thing, and it's like the common people. You're talking about people slumming it for kicks, but you don't get it, and you never will get it.
No,
and I love that it's just got all these layers to it, and it can mean different things to you at different times.
But I think there's probably very very few musicians that will write a lyric intentionally creating every layer for every person. I don't think, you know, when you read those, there's like songmeanings.org or whatever, and you see in the comments, well, I don't read it like that. Well, I don't read it. I don't read it like that. And obviously, when a songwriter writes a song, there's obviously they're going to be writing it with a meaning, or maybe a couple of meanings, or three or four meanings.
Yeah,
and maybe they are being clever with it, but I don't think that there's ever been a musician who will know exactly what everybody's going to read into their song.
Yeah, see, I got it more as, I thought I got it when I was a teen, but I didn't really. It was actually it's saying something about, it's a commentary on society.
Yeah.
It's not all about me.
Well, but it could be that, or it could be that your teen self got it, and then your adult self got it. It doesn't, you know.
Yeah.
I think what you read into today, or I don't know, Bullet with Butterfly Wings, or you know, 1979 by Smashing Pumpkins, is different to what I read into it. And it's like that whole thing we said in an earlier episode about what makes you. There is no real you, because there's only the other people's perceptions of you. How you hear a song, or see a picture, or read a book, or you know, experience the world is even though we bond on so many different things, our perceptions of the same thing are still different.
Oh yeah, and
so we can have the same opinion of a song, but there'll be slight nuances where it differs.
Yeah,
and I think that's wonderful.
It's going to be something slightly different to everyone, just as everyone has their own perception of you. Like you say, everyone will have a very slightly different perception.
Yeah,
and hear different things in it. But I still haven't let you get through the original point you were making about music tying to mental health and the article.
I have actually most of it. The thing is that music helps you with mental health. I mean, this particular article this person wrote said that they have music that gets them out of bad times, that puts them in a better place, keeps them safe, makes them feel less vulnerable. And there was a quote that this person put at the end of their article that says that music speaks when words can't. And I really like
lovely.
That.
Yeah.
Because it's not about necessarily just about the lyrics. It could just be about the tune. It could just be about the composition. It could just be, you know, it could be any element of that. And you do feel like when you find a band or a musician or a type of music that you like, you've got an ally, and that ally is unique to you. It's personal to you. You put a playlist on, you know, when you used to make playlists on tape,
mixtapes. Yeah.
God, you know, you'd labour for hours working out what, you know, the segue out from one into the next song and how it would work,
I remember the first CD player I got and finding out that you could program. So if I had compilation albums like Now and the best series, like the best rock in the world ever, the best indie in the world ever.
Jeremy Clarkson's best driving anthems.
Well, no, I never had that.
But you did.
And find it, so it's like, well, I wouldn't have arranged it like that, because or if there was a track you didn't like, and I had a Sony Discman. Do you remember those?
Wow. I it's always slightly too big for my coat pocket.
Too big for your coat
it
pocket?
It wasn't I didn't have a Sony one. I wasn't like wealthy like you.
Wealthy.
I think it was an Alba.
But you couldn't, it wasn't portable in any way, shape or form. One, because it was too big.
Yeah.
And two, because if you breezed wrong, it skipped.
Oh yeah,
it wasn't the like posh one. It didn't have. It was like the entry level model. It didn't have the anti skip that didn't work either.
It used to absolutely boggle my mind that there were people who used to drive cars with their Sony Discman on the dashboard.
Oh, with the thing that went
into the tape thing.
Yeah.
But it didn't jump. I didn't understand magic.
Yeah. But yeah, I used to spend ages like programming exactly what order I wanted to listen to. When I found out you could program to pick your CDs, and it's like I can make my own mixtape every day.
Yeah.
And I can listen to things in a slightly different order. I never did, because once I'd picked that order, that was the order they went in my head.
Right. So if you did that, what would it be? What's it like later when you listen to the album all the way through? Does it feel wrong in your head? Because you're so used to listening
to it. Yeah, it's like when you watch a film that you've seen 1,000 times before. Like if I watched the original, the first Ghostbusters, there's still bits where there's an ad break there.
Yeah, Superman 3 for me.
When Lewis locks himself out of his apartment
and
he realises he's done it again, it's like ad break. I expect to see the little stripey bit in the top corner.
Oh yeah, the Video Plus thing. Yeah,
no, that tells you there's an ad break coming up.
Yeah. Oh, because
yeah.
It was in the top corner.
But that was another thing. It was like to me they went in that order. Mm. And if I hear the song, on the radio or you know, just if it's on, if I've got a random playlist on, from Amazon or something, I expect I expect to hear the opening bars of something else.
Yeah, absolutely.
Would have worked better with actual examples of songs, but I can't.
can't picture them. My oldest friend Simon and I got into dance music in the sort of late 80s, early 90s, but we were far too young to be, you know, going to the Hacienda. I think we were like 11. So yeah, I think, you know, even with an expertly drawn on fake moustache, I think there would be
built up shoes.
Unless we sat on each other's shoulder, you know, did the long coat thing.
Yeah.
But we got into
that 7 foot bloke series.
Yeah, we got into
balance isn't very good.
That implies that I was 3.5 feet tall as a child.
I suppose if I sat on your shoulder.
No, okay. I forgot to adjust for that. But we got into dance music, and Simon's knowledge of dance music, because he got a bit obsessed with it in a great way, because his collection of music is amazing. But he used to create playlists at school to listen to on his paper round, and he did loads for me. He did this one set, and I'm gutted because it got water damaged when I moved out of my house when I got divorced. But I had this set of eight or nine tapes, and each one had each one was curated by him and through all of his records, and they were as a collective piece of music they worked really well, because he had an intrinsic understanding of, you know, lead in and lead out. Not so much like the, you know, like the DJ as such, because you know you're mixing halfway through and stuff. But some of I can still remember those tunes in order, on some of those cassettes, and that's lovely for me.
I think we spoke to a friend recently about when she was at university, in America, and she had one of her roommates one year had come from a very very, very conservative background.
Yeah.
Like quite isolated Jewish,
Orthodox Jewish background.
So had no knowledge of music at all, really. And she made her mixtapes or mix CDs.
Yeah.
Different, and the, each one had a different theme, and there were all these kind of rules that she set up, like no repeat artists, and
and
they had to be chronological. They had to be in chronological order.
Yeah.
On the, yeah.
I think so. That's wonderful.
Like, so you could see the progression in the music, and it's like, and I love it that things like that. It's like this. You kind of go, oh, someone else gets it about have this almost irrational attachment to music.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of lost. I know there's certain some companies where you can buy cassettes that look like cassettes, but they're actually like the USB drives, and you can create a mixtape that way.
Yeah, I think that's quite cute when you can do that.
But I mean, we have lost that, because sitting with your hand on your finger on the pause button and setting up the next tape to do the next record
and trying not to get a whoop
a whoop noise at the end of it or at the beginning of each song, or the click of the record. That it's a very personal thing to sit there for 90 minutes, and at least 90 minutes, because you've got to cue everything up, you've got to work out what order you're going to put it in, you've got to write that card down, you've got to put it all on, you know, and you can.
There's never enough space on the inlays.
Especially if you've got like bands like Jesus and Mary Chain or Echo and the Bunnymen, that takes up a whole line.
When you realise that you can write, you just write Carter USM.
Yeah.
Instead of, but and then you start write Carter and the Unstoppable, and then realise that it's going to take about four lines.
And then you have to start drawing round the bottom, or PTO and
go on to I did all that. But the other thing, I mean. It was a rite of passage getting your first double cassette.
Oh.
I remember.
Oh, you're so much fun with high speed dubbing.
Oh, yeah.
Superb.
High silliness. Which you don't get anymore. But the thing is, even if, you know, tapes say they're water damaged, but tape degrades. And I think that's the advantage. A mix CD, well, you or a mix playlist or whatever, that's going to stay as it is, whereas if you made a mixtape, there'd always be something where, you know, you'd accidentally gone into the next song before you realised and switched the tape off.
Yeah.
Running across the room. Mm. So you'd get a little whoop of another song. Or you didn't have it, so you taped it off the radio and you'd have
you'd get
radio jingle coming in or whatever.
You'd get Steve Lamacq's voice at the end of,
and listening to it on a Walkman that was running out of battery.
Oh, brilliant.
It's just suddenly like, I'm sure this song's meant to be faster than this. Then you put new batteries in, it goes slightly too fast when you put new batteries in.
My first Walkman didn't even have a rewind.
No, I remember that forward. Having to
turn it round and fast forward it.
Mental health.
Yeah, but that's brilliant, because, you know, we've touched on it. Of course we have. But it's different for different people, and it's important for different reasons for different people. And that is where it ties in to mental health, because I've got a tremendously warm sense of nostalgia now about music. Not just the music itself, but the things that happened around music. Going to George Heapy's in Knaresborough with my best friend and going through those records to find something good. Picking up a £1 Lucky Dip set of 12 inches and they were all shit. things like that, going to music fairs, going to concerts, going to the Harrogate Arms for the first time. They had a nightclub in the basement called Roscoe's, which was, in retrospect, it was a dive. There were slugs on the floor. It absolutely stank.
Sticky
carpet, stank of fags, stank of stale beer. But it was bliss. It was where my formative years. That was where I found myself.
My people.
Definitely. That's where you find that place where you find your tribe is almost always around music.
Yeah.
Depending on where you come
from. Yeah.
Certainly for me, and certainly for my peers anyway. And that's a wonderful thing, and that has you know, and again, the podcast is not just about, you know, what things make you better when you're having a mental health crisis. It's about the things that shape you emotionally. And music for me shaped me emotionally more than films, more than books, more than school. Music is incredibly important to me, and you know, and I think for a lot of people it is, and for a lot of people it really isn't.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And that's fine as well. Yeah. You know, some people don't have that relationship with music, and that's all right. It's just different strokes for different folks.
It's fine. I mean, it was interesting. On Friday, quite by chance, getting in late after a night out, and we watched BBC Four, which have a lot of music documentaries on, and I don't watch it. Whenever I watch it, I always think I should watch this more because it's really interesting.
Mm.
They had people talking about Bohemian Rhapsody and when that came out and how it was received and all the suggested meanings behind it. And it was very much a talking heads thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, they spoke to Brian May on it as well. And they had footage of interviews with Freddie Mercury around the time it was out. And, you know, you could see that a lot of people are very attached to it. And then but that was followed up by David Bowie live at Glastonbury in 2000. And, you know, it was seeing that it was the pyramid stage and you see the crowd and everything.
Yeah.
And that was the kind of shared experience that you get through live music. We've certainly had that at gigs and festival's very different because you see different bands and it's you know, you've been sat out in a field all day and you there might be bands that you catch that you've never even heard of. When the last festival we went to was the death metal festival, I hadn't heard of any of the bands, but had a great time.
Versus Stoner festival,
and most of them were brilliant.
Yeah, I you know, for anybody who likes their doom or stoner metal, Hard Rock Hell do a Doom versus Stoner weekend, and it's brilliant. It was ace, and the crowd to a person were superb.
Everyone was super friendly, and although we did come up with a great made-up game.
Yeah, make up your own fake death metal band names is my new favourite thing. I can't repeat 99% of them on here because they're dreadful. But that was fun.
Yeah.
That was definitely a fun addition to the weekend.
Yeah.
But before we wind up, I must say that we talked a bit earlier about the Ellis James and John Robbins podcast. John Robbins is a self-proclaimed and quite obvious obsessed about Queen, absolutely obsessed with it, and obviously this new film's come out, so he got to interview them, and you can tell that he knows more than your average press junket journalist about it, and I think that comes across in the interviews, that they really warm to that. But moreover, from the music point of view, his obsession with Queen and other bands like Godspeed You Black Emperor and Van Morrison and Frank Zappa and things like that come out when they do their thing at the end of each podcast, certainly for the last few years of it anyway. They've done this thing called the Keep It Sessions, which is every week they take it in turns, Ellis James and John Robbins, to play a track or a bit of a track from one of their favourite bands. And they've got a Spotify playlist which has each one of these tracks on it, provided they're available on Spotify. But what's interesting about that is for each one, they talk about when they first heard it, why they like it, what it means to them, and, you know, what they've got from that. And it's really interesting because the stories vary to an enormous degree. I mean, a lot of John Robbins's are quite based in, you know, unrequited love and obsessions about music. But it's really nice to get... You get a really honest and raw insight into somebody's mindset and makeup when you hear why they like certain pieces of music and when they first heard it and what they were doing. I think music really opens the door to understanding people because it's so subjective.
I always find it interesting when people talk about why they like the music and where they were when they discovered it. I mean, there's things that you kind of... I mean, it certainly happened to me where there's been bands that I've never really listened to, and then it sort of passed me by at the time, and then I'll hear it later and go, oh, this is what all the fuss was about. I get it now. This is what all the fuss was about. And I think there's a lot of pop stuff that's quite poppy is like that for me, because when I was in my teens, I was like, you know, you were into a particular type of music.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that changes as you age. When you're a teen, you are into metal, or you know, you're into rock, and you can be into indie and metal, but you couldn't be, certainly at my school, that meant you weren't into dance and you couldn't be into dance.
Yeah, no, see, the thing is, I think there was a bit of that at my school, but I think I was into both, but I definitely had to eschew one for the other for a while.
Yeah, I wasn't, like, if you were into rock, you weren't into electronica in any form. And then when I was a bit older, I sort of, when I started going out and discovering the kind of clubs that I like, I discovered techno music.
Mm.
And so I went back and listened to a lot of stuff from the early, well, from the 80s onwards, really, and kind of went, oh, right. It wasn't that I didn't like it, I just dismissed it because it wasn't my music at the time.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of stuff that I came to later that a lot of friends have a lot of memories associated with, and I don't have that because I just dismissed it at the time.
Yeah.
But all my stuff's linked to different types of music.
Yeah,
different
music. And that's brilliant, and that's what shapes different people in different ways, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. Which is a good place to wind it up. But again, as ever, please do let us know with your comments on this episode. I'm sure music is going to be something that's quite divisive, and rightly so. Not everybody likes the same stuff. Had a lot of really interesting comments about last week's episode about microdosing. A lot of links to further research and conferences happening next year in relation to further research into the use of ketamine for PTSD, ecstasy for Parkinson's disease, those kind of things. So that'll be really interesting to revisit in a few months, or maybe a year's time, to see where that's going. But as usual, it's podcast@thinkinghabits.co.uk for the email. On Instagram and on Twitter, it's @thinkinghabits, and we're Thinking Habits Podcast on Facebook. So as we sign off every week, keep talking, and if you need to talk, you know where we are.
Bye.
Bye.